Hello and welcome to the Music Retailers Podcast. I'm your host, Donovan Bankhead, and together you and I are going to listen to and learn from some of my favorite instrumental music retailers, manufacturers, well, anyone else that I think would be interesting. My goal is to provide a podcast where you can learn something new in every episode.
That's my number one fear, is that I'm going to be an hour into a conversation realizing that I never hit record. Hasn't happened yet.
I've done it twice.
Well, today we've got Nick and CJ Aberwater from Amro Music, and I am so excited to have you guys on the podcast today. It's going to be really fun. One of the few times that we've ever done a multi-person podcast, so this will be neat. And Amro has been, for me, one of the, I've always looked at Amro as one of the mentor businesses in our industry. Between Chip and Pat, you guys have been so gracious of sharing and helping and answering a litany of questions that I would have. And I've always just looked up and admired to you all. And it's a real honor to have you on the podcast today. So Nick and CJ, thank you so much for being here on the Music Retail Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Yeah.
Excited to be here.
So you guys have different roles and that you kind of handle the business, and we certainly want to get to that. But first, give us kind of a quick history on the history of Amro Music and maybe some of your predecessors that were involved in bringing Amro to your involvement today.
Yeah, sure. So Amro was started in 1921, celebrating our 100th anniversary this year, which is pretty awesome. Our great-grandfather, Nick and I's great-grandfather, was a classically trained pianist in Cincinnati, and he and his friend Frank Moorman were on a train going to Los Angeles, and they had a layover in Memphis. I guess you called it a layover when it was on a train, but so they were walking around the cobblestone streets of Memphis, and they realized that Memphis needed a music studio. So they continued their trip. They came back, and in 1921, opened the doors of a piano studio, and that's all they did in the early days. They had a second floor studio, and they would open the windows and they would play as loud as they could. And when someone would wander up the stairs, they would sign them up for an 8-week class.
I wonder if that strategy would still work today, because we're booking our lessons now and people are starting to sign up. And, you know, we might try that. We might just try putting a PA out in the street and see if that works.
You should. Why not? And then, you know, as the years went by, they kind of slowly added instruments, primarily for their students, and accessories. And then when school band became popular, they noticed that there were a lot of these rural band directors that couldn't make it all the way into the city to get reeds and supplies. So they loaded up in their Model T and they drove all over the gravel roads of Tennessee and Arkansas and Mississippi and made calls. Oftentimes they'd have to stay on the couch of a band director's home because they couldn't make it back before dark. So that was it. So we just kind of slowly have expanded throughout the years and continued to evolve.
Well, and that's a tradition that continues today, that you guys have school road reps that are, I don't know if they're sleeping on directors' couches or not, probably, but they are all over, not just Tennessee, but all over Arkansas, Missouri, and Illinois. I mean, they're just kind of going everywhere, even though you have a single location, but you kind of have reps that are kind of really covering multiple states.
Yeah, that's right, Donovan. So our reps on average drive about 7,000 miles each week. So they cover a really large amount of geography that they're driving. And so CJ and I always joke that we're eagerly awaiting like a Tesla cargo van to come out that is battery powered. But the reality is until just a couple of years ago, when we kind of dipped our toe in the Nashville market, you know, we had only really known these rural farming communities that CJ was talking about. And so that's why, you know, our reps are living out in these areas that you mentioned, is that's the kind of, for the most part, the school markets that we call on are these small rural farming communities that start 15 beginners, 18 beginners. We have our fair share of those programs. So just over the years, as CJ mentioned, the evolution came along and this is where we are today.
So how do you handle the logistics when you have a school service rep that may live quite a ways from the store? I'm assuming many of them, some of them will live quite a ways from the store, but they've got to come in to pick up reeds and supplies. And of course you have repairs. How have you guys handled that?
Yeah, that's definitely a house of cards that we try to continually improve upon. You know, we are the proud lessors, I guess I should say, of a number of storage units out in these storage facilities all across the Mid-South. So when the reps do come in, we try to take advantage of it. We load them up, but it does require us to have, you know, good processes, good information so that the reps are as independent as possible, that they, you know, as they can be out there driving down the road. And then, you know, we are fortunate being here in Memphis, where the world hub of FedEx is located. It does provide us some logistical strengths in that, and, you know, FedEx can pick up at 5:30 on a Tuesday night, and we can land something very affordably on the school's doorstep by 10 a.m. the next morning. So we are very fortunate to have great neighbors here in Memphis of FedEx, and work with them on a number of shipments and outbound packages.
So how about repair? How are you handling repair? Do your school service reps, are they trained to do some repair, or are you shipping it in to Memphis and then shipping it out, or how's that handled?
A little bit of all of the above. Again, we've got some logistical systems in place that allow us to move the repairs around. We've got some affiliates that we work with, some wonderful partner repair shops that can take care of instruments out in the field for us. And then, you know, Donovan, as we're sitting here speaking right now, I'm looking in our security camera, and we've got a big yellow Penske truck from our Arkansas rep that's backed up right now unloading. And she's bringing all the repairs in from Northeast, you know, the last 48 hours of pickups in Northeast Arkansas. So it's just very much when the repairs are here, we got to ensure that we do them quickly. We get them flipped out the door, because we recognize that a student without an instrument is a student that's falling behind in class. They don't have the tools to be successful. They could possibly be a distraction for that music educator. So when those repairs do land here at Amro Music, we flip them very, very quickly. And our goal is to get them in and out and back into the hands of the student as fast as we can.
So we talked about how the thing got started. Tell me how your parents got involved and how you all ended up getting involved.
Yeah. So obviously it was our great grandfather, and our grandfather and his brother and their sister were involved in the business, and they all kind of ran branches. And then our fathers got involved in the business. And then, of course, we were never pressured, fortunately, but we were encouraged. But the one thing that I appreciate, and I think what's really allowed the wheels to stay on this thing, is, you know, we weren't given an office when you started on day one. I mean, you worked your way up. So Nick and I both swept floors and priced individual sheet music back when that was a thing, and worked in the repair shop and knocked on doors. And, you know, we each had road routes for several years. So we've worked our way up through it. And, you know, it's great because we have this bond with our dads and with those who are involved in the business. But it's also important when you're running a family business like this, that those people around you get to know you and have confidence in you. And you're not just given a management role because of your last name. You truly have to work your way up in the business and prove yourself to them. And because otherwise they're not going to respect you. You've got to know what you're doing each and every day. You can't fake it here. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm really appreciative for the opportunity. And we probably had some crosswords to say when we were asked to, you know, to clean the bathrooms and do those types of things. But looking back, I certainly don't regret a single minute of that. That was an important part of a family business.
And I think we give a lot of the credit to our grandfather, Bob, second generation, because he was really the one that recognized that there were multiple family members that were interested in getting involved in the business. And he set some very clear expectations. And just because we have the same last name doesn't mean that you'll be invited into the family business. He was very vocal about that. And then because you are invited into the family business, it doesn't mean that you become an owner or a partner or anything like that, that there were checkpoints and expectations that went along with that. And the light shined even brighter because you had the same last name. The expectations were even higher. And so those expectations have been in place now for three generations, and they're expectations that CJ and I still uphold to this day for each other.
That's amazing. That's such a challenge with every, of course, multi-generational family business to deal with that transition. And it's not uncommon to get founders that, you know, kind of have success, get it off the ground, but then for it to falter. Because a lot of times the succeeding generations, there's a sense of entitlement because they share the same last name, because they're family, that they should be able to be there. Sometimes there's a sense of responsibility, maybe not even entitlement. Maybe they don't want to be there, but they just feel like they have to be there. So they're there. And it's such a challenge, I think, to keep these businesses healthy and growing and strong, the way that AMRO's done it, but you guys have always have been very intentional about this process.
Yes.
Since your grandfather's time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, and this is reflective of all business owners, not just AMRO Music, but we have to appreciate the fact that our decisions impact the lives and livelihood of the people that work for us. I mean, people come to work at AMRO and they trust us to make good decisions so that tomorrow they'll have a paycheck. And that's a weight that CJ and I talk about and that we carry, and that any family conflicts, fortunately, there are none, or at least not that I know of. CJ might have a different opinion on that. but fortunately, you know, we come in and we put on our business partner's hat rather than our cousin's hat when we walk through the doors of AMRO Music, because we recognize that's what our employees expect of us. That's what our team expects of us.
Well, before we started, I had CJ just email me a list of all the conflicts that he has. So quite a few here that we'll be going over. So
yeah, ding, turn the page now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, come on. Don't throw me under the bus there, Donovan. Come on, man. No, you know, Nick's right, though. I mean, you know, for a family business to work, you know, there's drama in a family, there's drama in a business, and you got to keep the two things totally separate. Fortunately, we don't. I mean, we both have our own unique set of strengths, and they complement each other. You know, there's a few things where we kind of overlap, but for the most part, they complement each other. And I think we have to recognize, you know, in any relationship, business owners or otherwise, you have to recognize the strengths of the others, and you have to say, you know what, you've got this. I'm going to get out of your way on this one. I think that's so important from an ownership standpoint and a family standpoint too.
You had mentioned when we first connected to, this afternoon, about the kind of natural proclivities each of you have, that CJ, you tend to handle more of the kind of accounting and organizational side, administrative side, and Nick is very involved with more of the front-facing aspects, sales. And we were talking before about the podcast and webinar that Nick puts together that's so fantastic. I'm assuming those just came off of natural interests and strengths that probably bear up from childhood and early involvement and just things you gravitated to. Wasn't necessarily a, well, this needs to be done, so I guess I'm doing it even though I'm not interested in it, and over time I've gotten good at it. Which sometimes happens, right? I mean, that can happen sometimes.
I think a lot of it is the natural stuff, Donovan. I mean, sure, to your point, some of it is, you know, this needs to be done and we need to just do it. But a lot of our strengths were natural strengths to us. I mean, Nick is a natural born speaker. He can stand up in front of a group of 1,000 people and off the cuff, you know, make a total cohesive and perfect presentation. I've got to have about a month ahead of time to make that presentation. And even then I'm going to mess it up. So a lot of it is natural. You know, some of the things, sure. Yeah. You talk and you say, look, we need to take care of this. I don't mind jumping in and doing that. But that kind of goes back to having the right people in the right seat on the bus. And I think as an owner, you also have to recognize I may not be good at certain aspects of being an owner. And so I need to find someone who is strong at that and just hire them to do that.
I have to mention here all this background noise that you hear during this recording, the clicking and whatever, is my wonderful dog Sarge, 70-pound German Shepherd, playing with a tug toy. So Sarge is basically my co-host on most of these episodes. So when you hear sounds like that, that's usually him playing or him going in and out of the dog door, his tail hitting the mic stand, any number of things. So just bear with me here.
And I'll give CJ a tremendous amount of credit too. One of the things that he's really pioneered at AMRO Music is the predictive impact index, the use of the PI. And that's something that before we hire anybody, we get their PI index and we ensure that it aligns with their natural strengths. So it's very natural for us to have conversations at AMRO Music about people's personality strengths and ensuring that the position aligns with what it is that they're applying to do. And so when you have that much conversation about people that you're hiring, the conversation naturally also flows into our own personal strengths. And so for us, I think we have a very good recognition. CJ mentioned, I'm a little more comfortable talking in front of people, but I bring all of my crystal reports that I need written, all of my challenges, all my computer problems. And CJ's like, oh yeah, you just do this, this, and this. And I'm thinking, I don't know what you just did, but I'm so glad you're a magician with this stuff. And so it's very much just an appreciation of, you know, hey, this is what I really do well. Can I do what CJ does? Yes, it takes me forever. Can CJ give a speech? Yes, he needs a little head start. But I think, you know, the company is most successful when we recognize and align our strengths with the things that we're able to bring to the table.
So tell me what this PI thing was again.
Yeah, so it's called the Predictive Index. And I know you've mentioned on some of your podcasts some of the things that you guys use. And it's it's a personality assessment. It happens to be one of the most accurate ones that we've found. And it's actually based in science and proven and actually held up in court. And so you kind of identify a target and you say, all right, for this position, these are kind of the things that we need and look for. And then it'll actually go through and based on a series of adjectives, kind of describe what that person's going to be like, where their strengths are going to be. You know, are they going to be a details person or are they going to be, they call it by the book. Do they operate by the book or are they going to be more loose with rules? And you think about a salesperson type role, they're going to need to be a little bit more loose with the rules. You know, let's get the sale and then we'll take care of the details. But on the accounting side, I got to have somebody that's by the book. And you think about, you know, can someone shift, go from one to the other? They can, but it takes a lot of energy to do so. And you're going to wind up burning out the wrong person in the wrong position. So
you go in people's office and they've got their PI map or their graph on their personality. And we talk about it as managers. Here's how to communicate with the different managers and the tools that they need to be successful. And we've even had conflicts between managers before, and CJ's just handed them each other's PIs and said, y'all go back and study this and then get together and have this conversation again.
Yeah, we use it a lot on the front end of the hiring process, but it's kind of an entire employee life cycle type thing. You know, over the course of time, you know, you start to identify, you know, so they're not really performing in this role. Well, is it a mismatch? More times than not, it's a mismatch for their personality. And so there are ways to coach that. There are ways to slide them into a different position.
We use the Colby test, which is kind of similar, but also not. It's not about their personality or whatever, but it just explains how they would do work and then also where they get energy from when they work and how much energy they expend in order for their maximum usefulness, where they should be putting their energy. Maybe that's probably a better way to put it. Yeah. And that's been really eye-opening and interesting to see, especially when you have people who have different scores. I have some employees that are on our leadership team, which is all we're doing with at the moment. It's just the leadership team. But those who have similar scores to myself, we tend to easily see the world the same way and understand each other, typically don't have much conflict. And the people who see the world differently than I do and like to interact with the world in a different way than I do, we sometimes have potential for conflict, but we also sometimes have those opportunities where we just really admire what someone can do. And when we're in our right head space, we're admiring that other person's strengths and abilities. And when we're in our wrong head space, we're thinking like, you know, how terrible it is that they can't see what you see in front of you, so on and so forth, that they can't appreciate the things to you that are so plain, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. And we know that all conflict kind of arises out of this, don't we? You know, it's all a misunderstanding. Yeah. It's all seeing things differently.
Amro, obviously we're really focused in school music and pianos and things that maybe are kind of ancillary to that, print music and other items that go with that. And you all are servicing a huge area, but you're doing it out of one retail location. And Chip in his wonderful book, Retail Truth, which is like a retail Bible, talks about the perils of owning multiple stores and how, you know, always seems like such a great thing that multiple stores is, you know, a chance to multiply profits, and it often doesn't work that way. Tell me kind of how that experience, because that sounds like the voice of experience writing that, not just theory or conjecture.
So yeah, we had up to 4 different locations throughout the city at one time. And, you know, as any owner would recognize, it's difficult spreading a culture across multiple locations, much less if it's in one city. But in your case, Donovan, I know you've got stores that are hours apart, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's difficult. But you think about just the complexity of systems. If we have an issue here, we can walk down the hall and have a discussion right there. Now you're coordinating in those 4 different places at the same time. The other thing in our case was a lot of those stores were combo heavy too. And so when we decided in the 90s that we were going to focus on the thing we were best at, which is band and orchestra and pianos, that kind of the need for the 4 locations kind of went away as well. So it's the complexity, you know, four locations. I'm not even going to say it's four times harder. It's probably 8 to 10 times harder than just out of the one location. So yeah, they were pretty valuable lessons. And I can recall some of the conversations, especially around combo and everything, where they would just sit and they would do the numbers and they would go top to bottom and they'd look at it and say, well, there's no way, that's not right. The numbers, the profit can't be right there. And then they'd come back a couple of months later and they'd say, actually, you know what? It's probably right. Right. The first stage in all is always denial. Right. So they would do it. So it just was this very long, drawn out process where you kind of had to convince yourself, you know, no, these numbers are right. So that's kind of how that came about. And that, I think that went down about the mid 90s or so.
Having multiple locations, you're probably right. It probably is somewhere to 4 to 8 times harder than having one. But the profits, on the other hand, are 1 to 1.5 times as good. So
we could argue with that. We could argue about that. I think we have, haven't we, Donovan?
Possibly.
We've tried to convince each other of that.
I still think it's, I mean, to me, the math still is funny. Like, if something's 8 times harder, but the results are only the same or slightly better, I'm not sure that it's worth it.
Absolutely, right?
It's
absolutely.
Like if you run a block, I'll give you a cookie. If you run a mile, I'll give you a cookie and maybe a quarter. I'll just run the block. Thanks.
You're absolutely right. But
that goes lazy man's perspective right there.
You know? But you're absolutely right, Donovan. How many people say, you know what? I do X number of dollars out of this location. I'm going to open another one and I'm going to double it. And not only am I going to double the revenue, but the profit's going to double as well. And the math just doesn't add up.
And it never will make sense to you until you've done it. Yeah. You know, if because you look at it, you just think there's no way. There's too many synergies. There's too many economies of scale. There's too many things that go to my advantage that I can't come out ahead on this deal. And miraculously, somehow you cannot come out ahead on this deal. I totally get it. Now, you guys have been, I think, because of this focus too on with school music that goes back now for, you know, 3 decades, you've been able to probably change your landscape in terms of, you're kind of changing your solar system in terms of the market you compete with in terms of school service. And I would imagine that as you've specialized, you've probably started to clear out some of the stiffer competition for school service. Not that you still have competition for school service, obviously, but I would imagine that being specialized has made you a preferred provider for more schools in your marketplace, seeing as you're kind of a school music specialist. Has that been true?
Oh, I think it's probably changed over the years. You know, Pat and I sometimes laugh that sometimes our growth strategy is just to outlast the competitors, because we're just going to hang out and just keep having kids and training them to run music stores. And that's going to be our growth strategy. So we do talk about that. We have had a number of competitors come and go who the competitors simply retired or didn't have a clear succession plan and things like that. But, you know, we do try to earn the business every year. You know, we try not to take for granted that in some of these small rural communities that they've done business with AMRO for multiple ed reps and multiple generations. We want to earn that business every single year. And, you know, we have to respect the right that we can be fired at any given moment. And so I think that really keeps us fresh and continually forces us to elevate and say, okay, yesterday's exceptional service becomes today's expectation, right? Yesterday's exception is today's expectation. So what are we going to do today to be exceptional? And so we have to approach everything we do with a mindset of how do we get incrementally better? How do we build upon yesterday's successes and keep it fresh? So it is something that we have to combat, because I think the opposite of good is not necessarily bad in our business. It's just no movement at all. It's just lethargy. And when you're a 100-year-old company and you have people that have been on staff for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, we have to keep it top of mind. So it's something that CJ and I work very hard to do, is to continually earn that business.
So let's talk a little about what you guys do to earn that business. So specifically with each of your roles, can you tell me a little bit about that, what the day-to-day looks like for each of you?
Yeah, so I predominantly spend my days working with our ed reps and our sales team, repair shop. So you know, Friday, we've got all of our ed reps coming in. I'll be running that meeting. I'm working on some repair shop initiatives right now, trying to introduce some things that'll improve our customer service and turnaround time back there. And so for me, really, it's anything that's forward facing on the customer is where I'm going to spend most of my time. So spent a lot of time during non-COVID years at MEA shows and at the region shows, the region clinics, going to rental meetings and just assisting to the best of my ability there. I hate to use the word manage because we have such an incredible team, such an experienced team that they don't really need management. Sometimes they just need a little extra assistance and some answers to questions they have.
Yeah. On my end, it's really the systems behind, you know, Nick is out there growing it and we have to, me and my immediate team, figure out ways to keep up with it. You know, how can we continue to support new accounts? How can we continue to support new rental contracts, customers, you know, without just totally blowing the roof off of the expenses? You know, yeah, you can add somebody pretty quickly, but in the long term, that may not be the right solution. So to Nick's point, it's asking a lot of questions and looking at some of the issues we're having, but also looking ahead and seeing what are the potential issues coming up on the horizon.
Some of our favorite questions to ask, you know, each other, and it really fires the whole company up, Donovan, is, you know, we'll do something really simple, like pass around the letter that the director hands out before the rental meeting and say, how do we make this better? How do we get one more parent to come to the rental meeting? What questions are parents asking because the letter confused them? So they're calling our accounting office. So some of these initiatives require the entirety of the company. Go through and rent an instrument as a customer. Look at the videos. Look at the wording. You know, when are we using our internal nomenclature to describe something that the customer is not going to understand? So I think a lot of times we go through these processes and we have these expectations that, hey, I'm going to blow it up and rebuild it and it's going to be better. But that's really not the approach that we take. It's how can I get one more appointment, one more rental out of each school that I call on, and evaluating everything through just that lens? What can we do to be just a little bit better rather than reinventing the entirety of the wheel?
That's so clever and impactful, because you're right. If you think about how do I get one more rental, and you think about how many schools your typical school music dealer calls on, getting only one more rental would likely end up actually being a nice increase in your business.
And your expenses haven't increased at all. And so for us, that's the approach that we try to take, is how can we just be incrementally more efficient? How can we provide a level of service that just one more customer, that's all we're asking, selects us? How can each salesperson book one more appointment at the sale? Well, if every salesperson does it, and we've got 6 front counter salespeople, and they all convert just one more sale, that's a good increase, man. That's a great day. You know, we just sold 8 more instruments. That's a lot more attainable for us than, hey guys, how do we grow 20%? That's pie in the sky. But how can I get one more rental, one more sale, one more appointment? I can do one more.
And you build that on that day after day after day. You know, it doesn't take long until you're looking at really important gains and consistent gains year after year after year.
Yeah.
That's how you survive for 100+ years, right? Thinking along those kinds of lines.
We try to. Yeah. But again, nothing is assumed tomorrow.
Right. Well, you know, you may blow it all tomorrow, but you've done a really nice job up to this point. Let's talk about the job that you've done. So how has the pandemic affected AMRO, being so heavily invested with rentals and school music and so on and so forth? How have you guys fared over the last, you know, 18-ish months or so?
Yeah, I think like most retailers in the school music business, I mean, we have certainly felt it, and CJ can see it in the financials when he's doing the projections and everything. You know, we're very fortunate that we went into this with 100 years of financial stability and a staff that had the mindset of incremental improvement being 2% better. And so we felt like we introduced some things that we probably never would have introduced and tried some things that we probably never would have tried. There's quite a few things that we did that didn't stick, and there's a couple that did. And so, you know, a lot of people are aware of like the After Hours podcast that we've released. You know, that simply started as a webinar. That's really all it was, is let's get a couple of educators on Zoom and just throw some questions at them about how are you solving this problem. The first episode, we had 30. Hey, man, we thought that was great. The second episode, we had 100. Whoa, look out. The third episode, we had 400 log in, and it just snowballed. And we thought, man, this is just really taking off on us. And now today it's a podcast and we're doing all of these different things. And we would have never tried that had it not been for the pandemic. I mean, we stepped completely outside of our comfort zone on that. And it's something that we're going to continue to do into the foreseeable future. And so in many ways, the pandemic was just an opportunity to pause, to freeze, to question everything and say, is this as good as it could be? And are we meeting our customers where they expect to do business, where they expect to find their answers? And the pandemic simply forced us outside of our comfort bubble and to embrace those changes or make the year even more challenging than it would have been.
Certainly. So then what are your prognostications for the fall? Because you've got, you know, you've had so many of these conversations with your educators and you're so plugged in. What do you think this fall is going to look like for AMRO?
Yeah, there's a lot to be seen on that. And I know a lot of retailers are kind of looking to the future, staring into a very murky crystal ball, trying to figure that out. You know, I think we have to be very aware that there is a group of students right now who never really had an opportunity to participate in music. And I think as an industry, we need to be doing everything that we can to attract those students through recruiting, but also coaching educators and partnering with our educators so that they can have productive conversations with their administrators to ensure that those students get a chance. Now, there's a number of ramifications that are long-term if those students never get to participate in music. Just the students themselves are going to miss those opportunities. But if we don't go and attract those students, we could see resources shifted away from music education because of, you know, lowering enrollment numbers, dropping in enrollment numbers. We could see positions get eliminated because the numbers aren't what they used to be. And then those ramifications are going to follow up through high school into marching band into college and even through our industry, manufacturers and retailers. So, you know, our general sense is that, you know, the beginning band class next year should have a pretty good year. Educators seem excited to get back on the track, but we can't lose sight of those students who didn't get the opportunity to participate. We need to invite and find ways to invite them to join music and to be part of the music. Or there could be a donut hole that follows us for the next generation of music makers.
Are you seeing your educators finding various ways to catch those students who may have been lost before? Are they offering additional beginning bands? Are they doing after school type activities to bring kids in? What kind of solutions are you seeing your educators provide to get those kids that were missed?
It's all over the place, Donovan. You know, and I'd like to say that it's universal. We've been trying to bang the drum, and I'd like to say it's universal and everybody has embraced this mentality. It simply hasn't happened. And so I don't think we can give up on these students. You know, we owe it to them as musicians ourselves. I mean, we're all the product of music education, and we need to be fighting to ensure that those kids have that same opportunity that we had. We're better people because music was a part of our lives at the end of the day. And so we need to be fighting to offer those students the same opportunity. So, you know, going with that fighting, you know, mentality, it's a lot of just hand-to-hand combat in there. I mean, we got to be going in training educators and working with educators to have these conversations and to ask the challenging question. Hey, we didn't get to start a seventh grade band last year. What are we going to do this year to ensure that those students have an opportunity to participate in music? And that the responses, as you mentioned, Donovan, are endless. But if we just shrug our shoulders and go, it's the class that wasn't, they just missed out, they're never going to have that opportunity, it would be a tremendous step back for music education as a whole.
Yeah, it certainly would. Because if we didn't know the answer to that question in our territory, is why we started our podcast. You know, after a town hall that Eastman put together and with Charlie McGeaney, and they were asking, what's this fall look like? And I thought, gosh, I honestly don't really know. I know what some of our educators are doing, but I don't know what a lot of them are doing. Like, well, I'm going to call and find out. And as I started doing that, I was like, well, I'll just do a Zoom meeting so I can see their face. And then I started thinking, well, I could record that Zoom meeting and then maybe share it with other people that might benefit from sharing that knowledge. And all of a sudden you find people that are listening and being inspired. And hopefully that more and more of our educators are listening and coming up with solutions and how to get those kids that were lost the first go around. Some of our programs did okay last season. They, by hook or by crook, ended up pulling in the number of kids they normally pulled in. But I think the vast majority of them ended up pulling in but a fraction of what they'd had in the past. And that's a lot of students out there that will need to find their connection and their kind of purpose and their joy for life, especially through their academic life and beyond. And music is such a great fit for that for so many people, certainly myself included.
Yeah, Donovan, you just mentioned it. Now, I don't want to leave that stone unturned. Is right now, so many schools are trying to figure out how are we going to respond to the social emotional loss that our students experienced throughout the pandemic. And we have so much research about the benefits of music that students who participate in music are less likely to be truant, less likely to use drugs and alcohol, or more likely to graduate on time, or more likely to go on to college. We know the social emotional learning benefits of music. They're more likely to be connected with their peers and to feel empathy. We're trying to fix all of these problems as a result of the pandemic that research indicates music fixes. And as an industry, we've got to be waving that banner and we've got to be loud and proud about the fact that it's been a very challenging year and music is here to help. And every child needs to have a shot to participate in music.
You know, everyone in my immediate family had drug and alcohol problems, had issues with school. None of them went to college. I was the first person in my family to graduate from college and have a degree, to not have a drug and alcohol problem. Been married only once I'm still married to my first wife, let's put it that way. And so and that's been for at least until she hears this podcast, 24 years. And none of my other siblings really have that experience. The thing I had that they didn't have was music. I was involved in band. And I had a sister that did it for like a semester or a year, but that was it. And I know without a doubt, if it wasn't for my friends in band and the experiences I had in band and the enjoyment I had playing in band, and honestly, even the success that I had in band, wouldn't have the life I had today at all. And my life would be vastly different and not of the quality that I have today. I attribute all that to being a musician and being involved with school music. So I totally think you're right. I think what we do is so important. It's great that it provides a living for all of us and all that kind of stuff. Like that's wonderful. But there's a altruistic mission behind that as well. That's more than just straight capitalism. So
absolutely,
there's something really important to it. So I think that's kind of a nice segue to talk. Just let's talk a little bit about our industry. What are some of the things that are right about our industry in addition to what we just talked about? Like we just talked about how impactful the things that we do are to the youth in our country. But what are some other things with our industry that you guys feel like are really on point?
Donovan, we are so lucky to have a tremendous amount of support and opportunities from so many different organizations. I was just on the NAMM Advocacy Summit a couple hours ago, and they did a tremendous job putting these things together. But we also have organizations like IMG, like AIM, like NASMD. There is no shortage of ways to get plugged in and get involved and get to know people and learn from each other and share from each other. I've talked to friends who own businesses in other industries, and they have nothing like that. They don't have anything like that. So those organizations do such a great job for us each and every day. In fact, it's kind of that thing that, you know, if you don't get plugged in and involved, it's your fault. You know, these mm-hmm. opportunities are there. We need to seek them, and they're tremendous opportunities. So I think we do that really, really well.
I think we're also very fortunate to have such an incredible team at NAMM that's leading our industry association. Everybody knows the trade show if you're a musician, but when you actually see what they're doing behind the scenes, the continual improvement that they approach, everything that they do, the NAMM fly-in, the advocacy efforts that go in, what Mary Lewerson's doing. But it just every time I interact with Joe Lamont and his entire team over at NAMM and see everything, I'm very appreciative of the quality of the industry association that we have at the helm, guiding us through this last year. Quite frankly, I think it starts with Joe. I think we have an incredible leader at the top there at NAMM, and his vision trickles throughout the entirety of our industry. And it's very cool to be a part of that industry as a whole, but especially want to recognize what they're doing in the NAMM offices each and every day.
We are certainly fortunate. I remember hearing over the years, you'd hear people that would complain that they think NAMM doesn't do enough. And I think, gosh, man, like they already do so much for our industry and for each of us and our businesses through the things you just mentioned, but also through the NAM Idea Center and breakfast sessions that they put together. And like, and then the NAM YP, the mentorship program for youth in our industry. Like, they just do so much. And if someone wants to be connected to others and grow their business and have more success and enjoyment in their business and more involvement in our industry, they have so many ways to facilitate, make that happen. And yeah, I've tell people over and over and over again, Springfield Music would not be where we are today without NAM, without a doubt, not even close.
Yeah. Every year when you look at the lineup for that Idea Center, and then the fact that you can go back and watch recordings and you can share them with their staff. I mean, it's just, you know, they're flying in some of the best people on these topics to give these presentations. And Zach does such a wonderful job. So much like CJ said, and I don't know the individual and we won't throw shade on them, but if you're not happy with what the things that NAM are doing, I suspect you're just not looking for the things that they're doing, because they do so much great work for our industry.
Yeah, they're just not paying attention, are they?
Not paying attention.
They may just not be happy people in general, because there are those out there as well.
That could be it too. I think we could be it too.
Probably need to look at their PI. Yeah.
So all these hearts and flowers and love for the industry, which is great. What are some things about our industry that could be improved?
Well, I'll take a pass at this one. And I think it would be an awesome opportunity for our industry to take that next step forward. And so, Donovan, I suspect you remember this clearly. About 25 years ago, there was this marketing campaign called Got Milk. Right? Oh, yeah. Do you remember that? I mean, everybody remembers that. And to this day, it remains one of the most studied marketing and effective marketing campaigns. And it's been 25 years now since they ran all of that. And here we are still talking about it. And I think we have so many wonderful advocates for music education. I see the work, you know, we talked about NAM and NAFME and the CMA Foundation and all of the MEAs, and we have all of these incredible organizations. What I have found is most of the time that our outreach is typically to the people who feel the same way we do. We found ourselves a little bit in echo chambers where, hey, I think music education is important and you think music education is important, so let's yell at each other about how important music education is. And when you go to most of these MEA shows and a lot of these things, that's wonderful. But I think there's a whole nother level of people that we're not reaching who don't understand the benefits of music. And I think those are the people that we've got to figure out how to reach. And so I go back to that Got Milk campaign is, now, how do we have a similar industry-wide initiative that's just completely, you know, one message, Got Music, or something along those lines, where the people who are non-believers or who simply haven't yet encountered the benefits of music can't escape the message that we're putting out there? So I think that would be an awesome pie in the sky initiative for the collective music education community to come together and figure out, how do we reach the non-believers and bring them into our music education world? This is probably the prime example, right? Like, the people who are going to listen to your podcast as we're sitting here listening and talking about this, they believe in the power of music, right? They're a product of music. That's why they're here listening to this now. How do we get to that next level?
I mean, so certainly one can be involved with NAM. It helps facilitate a lot of state music education organizations. I'm involved with one here in Missouri, with music advocacy in our state. It's easy to get involved at a local level. There's likely state chapters in all 50 states. And in my state, at least, it's predominantly music educators involved, but they love having the outside input from someone that's coming at it more from the business side of it. So I think that's one way each person can get involved locally. And of course, NAM does the fly-in, which is an annual thing that's more of a national effort.
And you're right. I think the drive-ins and the fly-ins, where we are proactively going out and seeking the non-believers to talk to them about the benefits and really advocating for the importance of music in our schools, that's a great example of what the grassroots effort. And I know NAFME does a fly-in too, and I've heard absolutely wonderful things where educators are in the offices of our elected officials having these conversations. And those are the types of grassroots things that absolutely move the needle. But there's a lot of parents out there whose kids are choosing between football and band this year, or between soccer and cheerleading and band, or between all of these other things. And we've got to figure out how to reach those parents.
CJ, what are some of the things about our industry that you think could be improved?
That's a great question, Donovan. And maybe I'm too much of a glass. Maybe I'm not even a glass half full. I'm a glass full type of guy. Aside from Chris Behrens. No, I'm just, I got a rib him. He called me out on the Lululemon pants on an earlier episode, which if I can defend myself, I have to say they are the most comfortable travel pants I've ever owned. So, you know, what's interesting to me, and this probably goes along the same lines as preaching to the choir. Every time I go to NASMD, I meet somebody new that I've never met before. And you think NASMD is a pretty closed off thing. So it's interesting to me how many dealers are out there that you just don't ever hear or talk to. I wish there was an automatic way to just say, here's somebody you need to go meet that person. It's fascinating to me. I mean, right? We meet new people every time we go that have great stories. So, you know, I don't know how you fix that. But again, I don't know. I think we got it pretty easy, to be honest with you.
We talked a little bit about this upcoming fall, which is, you know, more or less kind of next year. What's your thoughts for what the next few years will look like? I know that there's a lot of hope and optimism that we're on the other side of the pandemic, that health outcomes are going to be improved. But there's also a lot of concern about the costs that we incurred, economic and otherwise, to get us to the point that we're at today. But over the next 3 years, do you have any thoughts on what you think may happen to our country, our economy, our world as we continue to recover through the pandemic?
$1 million question, that is. I wish
it's just
I had
thoughts or opinions. I mean, yeah. I know that no one knows, but like,
you know, I wish I had a crystal ball. You know, I think even the guys who are forecasting this just almost don't have a clue. I mean, I can tell you what we're doing internally. You know, we are hoping for the best and at the same time kind of preparing for the worst. I think we always have to keep in mind that we're a couple of quarters away from a downturn and we need to continue to focus on our strengths. And fortunately, our team has done a good job. I feel like we are in really good shape right now to kind of weather some of these potential storms. But just like COVID, we have no idea what's around the corner. I mean, who, even January when we were at NAMM before this hit, who anticipated that in 6 months, our front doors would be closed, you know, and we would be soliciting business via curbside pickup. So, you know, I don't know. I wish I knew the answer. But I can tell you, we're going to prepare. We're going to do everything we can. We're going to take the lessons that we learned and put them in place so that hopefully if something like this does happen again, we're even much better prepared.
And I think for us, I think as retailers as a whole, you know, I don't think things are going to go back to the way that they were. I think this pandemic lasted too long. And I think too many habits were created that simply will not change. So if we can't go backwards, the only direction we can go now is forwards. And we have to acknowledge that consumers' buying habits have changed. And if you don't believe me, just read Amazon's quarterly report and see how much their revenue is growing every single quarter. I mean, their revenue growth is greater than like our entire industry mm-hmm. in a quarter. And so, I mean, this is just indicative of the way consumers continue to shop. And I think we have to recognize too that whether it's Amazon or whether it's other things, that there are segments of our economy that continue to be commoditized by the internet. And that's not new before the pandemic, but the pandemic expedited that process even faster. So what are we doing as retailers? What are we doing as business owners to get above a commodity and to create a community? You know, if we don't have a community, we're simply selling a commodity. And so that's something that we all have to be taking to heart, whether we're selling the Peloton bikes, you know, where they're creating this Peloton community or selling musical instruments. You know, we've got to get our service and our network and our people and our relationships above the commodity process, or we're just going to be the next victim of Amazon or whoever e-commerce site it's going to be.
Building that community is such a key part of it. And of course, that's something that we can all impact and change. We just start by just doing it. And I guess actually you start by having your vision of what you want it to be and then keep working towards that. And I think sometimes that's one of the advantages for a younger, newer business is to have that energy and kind of clarity of mission and purpose. Like I started this because I want to do this thing and I want to achieve this and this is what I want it to be like. The disadvantage is they may not have the resources to live up their dreams and fulfill those things. Sometimes when you get a business that's established for 20 years, 60 years, or 100 years, it can be hard to kind of keep that zeal and that drive and that passion. What are some, maybe because you guys are the young generation and that's why, but what are some of the things you think dealers and manufacturers, businesses can do to kind of keep that passion alive for building their community?
Hmm. That's a great question. You know, how to keep the passion alive. I'm not sure CJ and I have really faced that because I'm not sure it really died on us quite yet. And so I think we're just, to your point, Donovan, I think we're still probably the beneficiaries of our youthful energy and at times our ignorance moving forward. But I think all businesses, you know, there's some realities that we have to continue to face, whether we're youthful or not. Very soon, we're going to start encountering customers and consumers who have never not had a cell phone in their hand. And you think about the shift that's going to come. I mean, we still have a group of, or at least as the school band dealer, let me rephrase that. As a school band dealer, we're very soon going to have customers who have kids who are walking into rental meetings who have never not had the internet in their pocket. They've never not had that. So how does that change their level of expectation for us as a school music dealer? It's pretty substantial. And so I think there's some coming trends that enthusiasm or energy or not, we've got to be prepared to embrace them or find ourselves being passed by another group of youthful, young, energetic music store owners that embrace it faster than we do.
What do you think some of those trends are?
I just mentioned it, the cell phone. I mean, the technology and it's the expectations of the consumer are no longer being simply set by our competitor down the street. They're being set by Amazon, right? I mean, that's the bar that consumers expect, whether we like it or not. That's the bar that they set in terms of their shipping speed, in terms of the ease of use of their website, their ability to navigate, to return items. I mean, all of these things are being defined by the e-commerce giants. And we as retailers either have to rise to the occasion and embrace it. You know, it's no longer just, you know, do I choose between music store A or music store B that's down the street? It's, do I get it from music store A or do I just hop on Amazon and purchase this instrument? And so I think that we need to be approaching these challenges with that level of expectation. Hey, I don't need to be better than the competitor down the street. I need to be as good or better than the people who are setting the expectations, the Apples, the Googles, the Amazons.
Well, and by the way, our websites and all the fulfillment parts are being judged by that as well. So it's not just even being in there. Donovan, first of all, can I thank you for saying that I'm in the young generation? That kind of makes me feel good. You know, I was listening to your last one on, you guys were talking about TikTok, you know, and I think a lot of consumers are going in different places and we've got to make sure we have young, energetic people on the team that can find the consumers where they're going to be, kind of the next point too. Everything we do is judged based on how well Amazon does it.
I wouldn't say I disagree. I think where my brain is spinning right now is I don't think I judge. I mean, I use Amazon. I hate it. I wish I didn't, but, I do. I even bought a music book from Amazon once. That was super frustrating. Like, I needed it right away. I'm going to get it faster from Amazon than if I order from my suppliers. Like, I can't believe I'm going to have to do this, but here we go. Bought a solo ensemble book from Amazon. But I think about like my experience, and maybe it's because I'm Generation X, so I'm the last generation that remembers a life before wireless remote controls, the life before the internet. You know, that might be influencing my thinking. So when I think of businesses, I don't necessarily always equate them to Amazon. I guess it depends on the size and the scale, right? So certainly when I'm interacting with Target or Walmart, then yes, I compare that to Amazon or something like that. But if I am dealing with a local business or a local baker or a hobby type thing that I'm interested in, I don't necessarily compare them to that. But I do expect other things from them. I don't expect Amazon to support and build the community of whatever my particular interest may be for that. So in our case, of course, we're talking music stores. So I don't expect Amazon to participate in that. I would certainly expect a music store that I patronize to be a part of building the community of musicians. And so, but I may not expect them to be able to offer all the same amenities and pricing that an Amazon does. So if they're not going to give me speed of service and unlimited selection and very, very low pricing, then they need to give me something in return to make them a valued choice.
The community.
Sure. Yeah.
But I got to tell you,
well, that's the track.
You know, I log into a website and I expect to see previous orders. I expect to see how quick. And if somebody says, hey, it's going to be delivered in 10 to 12 days, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm thinking I'm on to the next thing, right? I mean, even a doctor's office, you know, you expect to see your previous history, you know, your health, you know, when was the last time, sure, I was in the appointment, everything else. And I think Amazon, yeah, has really expedited that access to the information and the speed.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Well, this has been really interesting. So one final question that I always like to ask people is, if you could send a message to the younger you, what would you say?
Feel free to say no more often to things. I have a habit of saying yes when I probably should say no to things. So maybe don't be afraid, you know, don't be afraid to undercommit necessarily. It sounds bad, but, you know, a lot of these peripherals, it has to go back to prioritization. Right? Which of these things are going to be best for me personally and for the business, not the peripheral stuff. I find myself getting
like doing this podcast.
No, this has been fun. It's been a pleasure, Donna.
You know that I'm going to harass you more than the hour it would take to just do it. So you just might as well give in and just do it.
I expect nothing less.
This is why my wife gave up and married me, was because I just chased her down until she just quit. And that was that's my strategy. I'm persistent.
Yeah.
No, I think that's certainly good advice for many of us. I think a lot of entrepreneurs likely struggle. I mean, on the one hand, it's probably helped to get them where they're at today, saying yes to opportunities and the challenges and so on and so forth. But I think we get to a point where we need to start being, we need to curate some of those opportunities, maybe a little more than what we sometimes do.
Yeah.
Nick, how about you? Piece of advice to the younger you.
I'm still mentally tossing that question around because I think back, well, I would advise myself not to do that. But then I look back and think, well, that was some really good experience. I kind of needed to step on that landmine because that corrected some behaviors that needed to be corrected. So, you know, I probably took everything seriously when the reality was I lacked the filters to identify the things that needed 100% of my attention and the things that were not going to create the value in my life that I was putting into them. And so just having that experience, you know, I don't know if I could give myself one piece of advice, but it's just that recognition that can only be brought on by experience, that there are things that are going to come in front of you that require a great deal of your time, and they require you to step away from your family and your business and to do a great deal of things that offer a very low return on your investment and on your time and require a great deal of effort. And much like CJ mentioned, it's saying no, but also just recognizing those opportunities when to say no. You know, I think that's probably reflective of our business model here at Amrum Music. We're just kind of boring. We're in our box. We like our box. It's warm and you know, it doesn't rain a whole lot inside the box. And so we just kind of hang out there. And so when I know there's a lot of cool, shiny things outside of the box in our industry that we could be doing, but we're here and we're happy. And I think younger Nick would have appreciated that experience a little bit more.
If there's an award for the most unique and funny answer to that question, I think you just nailed it. That's
really, glad I could
that's
help.
Really good. I haven't heard that. I think I can relate to that, though, in terms of not that feeling of being content with what you do, you know, not content that you're not trying to advance and challenge and improve what you do, but knowing who you are and like, this is our wheelhouse, and we're just going to try to make this wheelhouse better and better and better. Man, there's definitely a peace and the strength to that. It's probably a large part of what's made Amro so good over the years. So a lot of wisdom there. This was a lot of fun, guys. Thanks so much
thank
for
you.
Taking the time to do it. I know you had a lot of things to do, but you know, I've wanted to hear from you both, and to have you on. Just if nothing else, from the respect that I've had for Amber over all these years and how helpful you guys have been. So it's really great to get to have you on and share a little more of the history and story. So I feel like exciting. You guys are one of the people, like, it's a name that a lot of people know, but they don't always know why they should know it. And having been through the stores and meeting some of your people, meeting you guys, hearing you all speak at NASD and other places, like, you know, you guys are kind of an unsung hero of our industry. Appreciate everything you do and what you're doing to help create community, both in our industry and also in music education as well. So it's really much appreciated.
Likewise, Donovan, we appreciate you and all you bring, especially with the podcast.
Yeah.
So one of my weekly listens.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I enjoy it a lot. I think I was joking with CJ that I would consider myself a first-time caller and long-time listener today. So I just appreciate so much the opportunity to come on here and the community that you're creating. I've heard some incredible conversations with people that you've hosted on here. So thanks for everything that you're doing. And, you know, we joked about having one location. We look at guys like you and just think, man, they got it going on over there. He's got four locations or five locations, and they're not even named the same. Like, how does he do that, man? That's incredible. So I promise you that the admiration and respect is mutual, Donovan.
Yeah.
Well, one of these days I'm going to write a book about what not to do, the story of Donovan Bankhead, and it's going to be all of the things
learned. A lot of lessons, huh?
At Springfield Music, we started using Merchant Cost Consulting earlier this year. These guys are former banking and credit card reps who go and negotiate your processing rates on your behalf. Now, like most of you, we're pretty aggressive about shopping our processing rate around, so I wasn't sure they'd be able to save us much money. But boy, was I wrong. On average, they're saving us about $600 a month. The deal is we split it 50-50 with them for so many months, and after that, all the savings are ours to keep. Plus, they keep an eye on your fees during this time to make sure those freaking credit card processors don't find a way to jack up your rate again. They're good folks, and they do what they say they do. Actually, in our case, they underpromised and over-delivered. They estimated about $500 a month in savings, and it's been closer to $600. When you contact Patrick at Merchant Cost Consulting, tell him that Donovan Bankhead sent you. This does two things. One, they will pay me a slight referral commission. But more importantly, two, you'll get 10% off of your first month's bill if you choose to go with them after their free analysis. Listen, I wouldn't recommend it to you if it wasn't worth it. It'll only take a few minutes of your time. They handle the rest. Contact Patrick McClellan. His email is patrick@merchantcostconsulting.com. P-A-T-R-I-C-K at merchantcostconsulting.com. I'll even give you a cell phone number, 508-733-7622. And remember, tell them that Donovan sent you.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. If you'd like help with your business, check out musicretailconsulting.com for articles, resources, and coaching and consulting services. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast so you're aware of future updates and rate and review while you're at it. Thanks for listening.